are listening to the Fan Morning Show. On the Sports 5-9 of the Fam, I'm J.D. Bunkus, Bayless Forfar, Blake Murphy.
Tax.
You decide. Choose your own adventure. Whatever you want to talk about, text 590-590. Hit us up in the DMs at JD Bunkus, at Ailish Forfar, and Blake Murphy. Before we get to text, I need to do a story with the two of you that I read early this morning, and I need to talk about it with somebody because I feel like this is one of those I feel like I'm taking crazy pills stories where I need more information. Okay, so Cracker Barrel, you're aware of the cheese, the Cracker Barrel cheese. It's a restaurant, apparently, too. I guess you can go to Cracker Barrels and you can have yourself.
You've never been?
Oh,
no,
I guess I lived in the States, so I went often, yes.
No, I've never been to a Cracker Barrel. And honestly, I've never even noticed one when I've been to the States, which has been many, many, many times. Just never stood out to me. But yes, Cracker Barrel, big chain in the States, not so much here. So a jury in Marion County, Tennessee, has ordered Cracker Barrel to pay a man $9.4 million after it found the company at fault for serving him a glass filled with a chemical instead of water. Okay, so I should start by saying that this guy, that the only medical information I have with him is that it has caused permanent internal damage to this guy. So it had a corrosive element, this chemical called Ecosan. So not to make light of this guy who obviously is going to be in pain and blah, 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 blah. But I'm going to make light of it. How do you not know you're drinking a chemical and not water that burns your esophagus? Like, I think that you should not get $9.4 million. Like, you're not. There's not some fault where someone brings you water and you go glug, glug, glug. Oh, actually, this is a chemical.
Maybe he knew.
No,
he was
that's
like,
what I'm
bring
saying.
Bring me the lawsuit, baby. No.
Okay, two things. How does this happen? Like, how do you go, like, can I have a water? And the person's like, yeah, no sweat. And they go back and they're like, can I get a jug of that chemical and bring the chemical out? How is there a chemical out there that looks that close to water? You know? Like, that
everything
it's that.
Everything is clear. Isn't bleach clear?
Everything
could've
is clear.
Bleach.
No. No, bleach. Yeah, you bring bleach up to your mouth and try to take a drink and tell me that you're going to confuse it with water. So, what, this is some odorless, tasteless, does this guy have COVID? He didn't have his taste anymore?
Like, actually.
That's what I mean. I need this full story here because this is ridiculous. Like, $9.4 million. If you drank a full glass of a chemical that you thought was just a glass of water, I feel as though the story that I'm getting here, you bear some responsibility. Like, I feel like I could hand a child a cup of chemical and be like, drink your water. And they would go, this isn't water. This is chemical. This is different. Like, how old are you supposed to be? 4 when you can make that decision for yourself when you know what water is?
Yeah, I don't know, man. It's you drink it sanitizer, bro. I don't know what to tell you.
9.4. I'll tell you, I'll be drinking that chemical down for 9.4 million.
Send it in simps.
I was going to say, so $9.4 million. I'm drinking some chemical. I'll take the esophagus burn. I'll take whatever this guy is enduring. If you got mouth burns, esophagus burns, and apparently this is permanent damage. But either
he's got
way,
$9.4 million. So
he's got $9.4 million. Worth it, big time.
Imagine
worth
if he
it.
Put some of that on the wake and rake, he'd be rich.
Yeah, he would be. Maybe that's what we need to get—is this guy to invest in the wake and rake.
Speaking of the wake and rake, we have a text in 590-590. Keep them coming, which says we've been searching everywhere for what a wake and rake is, but I can't find it. Could you have some more clarification on what that is? The wake and rake is the name for our morning parlay, and it comes from the idea of wake and bake, which you might know what that means, but rake as in raking in the dough, rake in the money. That's where wake and rake comes from.
It. I didn't know that it was from that. I would have never agreed to such a thing, you little stoners.
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
I didn't know.
Sure.
I just thought it was a cool rhyme, wake and rake.
Yeah, yeah, sure. Anyway, that's just a quick one. We have a lot of texts in the text line, so we'll just we'll blast through them. This is
hopefully
a fun one.
About people who drank chemicals.
No one about chemicals yet. Oh. Let them. Or maybe they're on a little delay. They're typing them out now. But here's one. No name, but rapid fire. Won't hold you to it. Just write the second based on feel. Who wins the 4 NFL games this weekend? I feel like we're going to be held accountable for this, but it'd be fun, guys. Come on.
Yeah, here's why I hate this question is because.
Come on.
Yeah, they're not going to hold me to it, but based on feel, okay, based on feel, then fine. Titans, Niners, Bills, Rams.
Whoa, okay. I'm going to go Titans, Packers, Bucks, Bills. Bills, because you know why, but I feel a little nervous about that game.
Bengals. Blake? Bengals, Packers, Bucks, Chiefs.
Ooh, okay. Love it. Next.
What was up with that reaction?
Just you're the only one that didn't pick Bills, so it makes and you always know stuff, so it makes me nervous.
Not on football. I feel like
he's got cratered the last 2 weeks by us.
True. So then maybe that's good. That's good. I like that.
That's why I don't throw him in the wake and rake. Yeah. I'm much more confident on basketball and hockey.
Yeah.
Here's a fun one. So. Jordan and Saga texts in every week. What a loyal guy. If you were NBA players, Blake would be DeMar DeRozan, just a genuine, nice, solid guy. Alicia would be JYD, just full of fun and energy.
Ouch. That's tough.
Just
okay.
Full of fun and energy. And JD would be Patrick Beverly going around annoying everybody.
I don't like this text. I really don't like this text. This is awful. I hate Patrick Beverly. Like, I really hate Patrick Beverly. And I respect most irritable or irritants. Like, I love rats in all sports. I really do. But Pat Beverly is just the, like, you're not good enough. You know? You're not good enough to run your mouth the way that you do. Also, there was nothing funnier than Patrick Beverly having the quote being the face of the Clippers run LA now. Only to not win a title and then to get traded. One of the first guys at it down when they said, hey, how can we make this team better? It's going to be trading Pat Beverly. So, Jordan, I hope you drink a big glass of chemicals.
Hey!
But it's no one's fault but your own and you don't get the $9.4 million, okay? How about that?
Yeah. Jordan, don't do that. Not endorsed. That's not a medical claim endorsed by the Fan Morning Show.
It's not
Thank
a
you.
Medical claim. Yeah, no, no, it's definitely not a medical claim. I'm hoping him harm.
Someone said, JD, you just did a full road trip through the East Coast and didn't see a Cracker Barrel. And I agree with that. They're literally everywhere on the side of the highway. You see it floating in the distance, Cracker Barrel, turn off at exit 5:30 for this. You didn't see any.
Yeah, but this is one of those things where, like, if you don't know to look for it, then you don't see it, right? Like, it's invisible to you.
Also,
like,
didn't you fly?
Oh, I did fly, but yeah,
you
that's...
You drove around a little bit.
No, but I also, like, the last time I was in the States, it was a long road trip through all of New England. Like, so I'm guessing that... I'm just going to guess that Cracker Barrels are hot. Hot in Massachusetts, upstate New York.
Yes, yeah, every 10 like, miles there's a Cracker
yes,
Barrel.
Yes, exactly.
Connecticut.
Yeah, so that's where I was last time in the States driving through. So I'm just saying I didn't notice. And we stopped at a lot of different not healthy food places. It actually was a real eye-opening experience in terms of obesity in the States when you go into any store.
There's not a lot of non-healthy places.
No, you go everywhere and it's just like, hey, you can have 8 hot dogs for $3 and you're like, I guess I'll have
all. You're free Twinkies with every purchase.
Yeah, exactly. I got to do it. I can't pass on the savings here. So, yeah, I didn't notice any Cracker Barrels. I'm sorry. I didn't look for it. It does remind me, though, of my friend when we first came up to Canada from that same area and who looked at me in the car and said, what the hell is Swiss Chalet? And
Swiss
Chalet.
That's good.
And I was like, all right, you don't have those. So, yeah, the Cracker Barrel is my Swiss Chalet. What's next?
This is a real question. So, good morning, guys. This is Greg from Kitchener. Thank you for being the co-driver taking me to work daily. What do you think about Nick Nurse using Fred VanVleet to close games? In my opinion, Nick Nurse do it when he bet against the Raptors because we lose games when the ball's in Fred's hands in the fourth quarters of games. That ball should be in Pascal Siakam's hands. When you're down 7 to 10 points, can we tell Fred it's not time to dribble showing skills? It is time to play a team game.
All right. You got to wrap these texts up sooner. Okay. You'll have to read the whole text from now on. It's
okay,
a new rule
okay.
for you.
Yes.
This is something that I've brought up before. Like, this is one of those texts where I go, you're kind of on to something, but then you just, like, kind of veered off the road with the whole Fred's not a team player thing. clearly Fred is the best shooter on the team, and he's the best guy from distance when they need three. So, yeah, he has this extremely long range, and players sort of give it to him. That pull-up works, so I really don't mind that. Like, last night, for example, that's a time where I want Fred with the ball. Siakam has also been really crappy in clutch situations basically throughout his entire career as quote-unquote the guy, so I don't really view it as a massive problem. I will say this, though. I would like for Siakam to now be the initiator more often than not if the Raptors are down two. And it is something that we've discussed a little bit. And so to, I don't know, try to elevate this question a little bit, I'll kick it over to you, Blake. But yeah, what do you think about just the idea of trying to incorporate a little bit more Siakam in late game situations moving forward here when the game is close or tied or they're down a basket or two?
Yeah, I mean, the conclusion here is fine. The way that it got there is a little iffy. Where, like, you know, what do you want? Do you want Siakam having the ball and he's not trying to pass it to find Fred VanVleet open off the ball? Like in the ideal scenario, both these guys are touching the ball because Pascal's the lead initiator and Fred's your best shooter. And like I said earlier, Fred is 11 of 22 on threes in these clutch situations. And he's been he's shooting 46% on threes in the fourth quarter, period. So it's not as if Fred is like not efficient when it comes to these situations. It's just, yeah, you have two really good players, and neither one of them is the guy. So, yeah, have the ball in Siakam's hands. But if you're bemoaning that Fred is taking a lot of threes down the stretch, well, guess what? That's their highest yield offensive option most of the time, including in the fourth quarter and in clutch situations if we want to narrow it down that way. So, yeah, I mean, I think the ideal version of any clutch offense is a little varied anyway because it makes it more difficult to defend and it puts some agency in the hands of your best players to make those decisions. The real thing here is just that, like, in general, they don't have a great half court offense, so when an opposing defense locks in and it's grinding it out in the half court, it's just not going to look as good as it does for the first 45 minutes or so.
All right. Well, this is another kind of follow-up to that just came in. Raptors trade deadline. What are we doing? It's a big question. What are we doing?
Yeah, I think this is, again, this is something we've touched on. And obviously the people texting in probably don't listen to all 4 hours. But you can subscribe to the podcast to check those Raptor segments out. But I think there are kind of three things you're looking at. And one is Goran Dragic, and maybe his salary is useful for something. Maybe it's not. And if it's not,
we're not allowed to talk
out
about Dragic anymore, remember?
I'm answering
only in this context.
Yeah, all right, allowed.
And then I think, you know, we talked about Chris Boucher a little earlier and what he could potentially be on the trade market. And then I think, yeah, if someone wanted to give you something for Malachi Flynn, they'd do that. These bigger kind of franchise altering, are you going to trade a bunch of chips or for a star? Or are you going to sell one of your borderline stars? Like, those are offseason discussions. Sure, Miles Turner would be nice. Miles Turner's also hurt, and the asking price is said to be very, very high. So another situation where I think probably an offseason discussion. I'd be surprised if they're big buyers and not just tweakers around the outside.
Blake, do you think that my fake OG Anunoby for Miles Turner trade sparked that one guy from Indianapolis to write that same trade rumor?
Maybe. I don't know how much people in Indianapolis are listening to Toronto sports radio, but
there's, yes. You'd be surprised. You'd be surprised, buddy. You'd be surprised.
The framing of, like, oh, yeah, they discussed Miles Turner and OG's name came up. Yeah, you know what that conversation was? The Raptors were like, hey, we'd like Miles Turner, please. The Pacers were like, okay, give us OG Anunoby. The Raptors were like, okay, we wouldn't like Miles Turner, please. That's how that one went.
We got a couple Leafs ones now. Pivot off Raptors. Mike says, why do you all insist that Matthews is the best or second best player when he averaged 12th in points per game over the last 4 years? This year, he's 16th. Draisaitl, McKinnon, Kucherov, etc. have always outperformed him. And then he goes on and gives a bunch more stats. But I'll keep it short, as JD requested.
Yeah.
So the texts
are not the only way to measure a player.
The texts are very contentious today. We have the people who that are like, here's you're the producer.
How dare you?
You're the producer. Here's what I'll say. Austin Matthews is unequivocally, unquestionably, undebatably better than almost every one of the players that you listed there. To me, you can have this conversation. Matthews or McDavid? McDavid. Matthews or McKinnon? Okay, that's up for debate. Matthews or Draisaitl? I think it's Matthews. Other people can say Draisaitl, whatever. Yeah, this isn't just a question about points. If anything, this is a question about goals. The hardest thing to get is goals. Goals are the hardest thing. That's why there was so much of a kerfuffle in this city over the idea that Mitch Marner compared himself contractually to Austin Matthews. Players who can create their own offense the way that Austin Matthews does do not exist. And so, I really don't need to go much further into it, is that go find players that can create goals for themselves the way Austin Matthews can. And I'll tell you what the list is. It's no one. He's the best at it in all of hockey. It's the hardest skill set to find. He's better than some of the guys who get points per game.
So during that same span, we'll use the span this gentleman used. First in goals per game, first in even strength goals by a long shot.
Five on five, like, he's a beast.
Yeah, like Draisaitl has 60 of his, like, they're tied in goals, and Draisaitl has 17 more on the power play. The other thing with Austin Matthews is he's a good defensive player as well. And he plays he plays minutes in a way that, yeah, of course you want that guy getting offensive zone faceoffs, but they still trust him in the defensive zone. He's a very good faceoff man over the last three seasons. And he's safe in his own end, to where, like, you could probably, if you weren't trying to maximize his minutes at 5-on-5 and on the power play so much, you'd probably be comfortable playing him on the penalty kill too. So there's not, goals are more important than assists, and being good at defense is also important.
Just to continue to bury Mike, he ends his text with, he scores many goals on empty net tap-ins with ton of puck luck and on uncontested shots, and you guys gush all over him.
I don't know where you're getting the empty net and puck luck from here.
He's got his own spreadsheet.
Austin Matthews wasn't Matthews' stat last year like he had zero goals on empty nets, that he scored like one goal on an empty net all year? Anyway, yeah, sure. Like, this is, we got to lower the priority on some techs when they do this move. Because, yeah, I'm fairly certain that one of the stories with Austin Matthews, well, again, I already know factually that he's the best scorer 5-on-5 since he came into the league. So, I would say out of all the guys that I picture as goals with tap-ins, Austin Matthews is like dead last. There's just some weird people out there who love to hate the Leafs, and that this guy, you know what? I feel bad for this guy because he lives in the city and he's not a Leafs fan, and he listens to these shows, and he's frustrated with the fact that the Leafs get a lot of coverage. And I get it, but it's like, hey, man, I don't know what to tell you. Move.
Okay, well, let's move on. So two questions about Muzzin, which is, I think, a hot topic right now. Adam and Guelph says, does Muzzin get traded at the deadline? And we talked about this, how he actually has a no-trade clause, and I don't think a lot of people have realized that, so probably not. And then another question saying, I was curious, do you think the Leafs kept Muzzin around because of the uncertainty of what was going to happen with Riley? I think that's an interesting point as well.
Okay, so a couple thoughts on this. One is that I'd like to really know from somebody what the actual value is, dollars and cents-wise, to no-move clause. Because Muzzin's deal wasn't exactly a huge price break at the time. It wasn't a controversial contract. So most people wanted it to get done, and I include myself in that. They got Jake Muzzin, and he was a revelation for this team. And the reason why this blue line is struggling so much and why people are up in arms about it is because he has not been himself. He's someone who has elevated every single defense partner he's been with, and he has brought a different element to that core that this team desperately needs. I'm all about, with a good roster, a good NHL roster especially, having different balance and people who bring different elements to the team. And Muzzin is a blue liner who does that, right? Mm-hmm. He brings a different element. He was a physical guy. He came with Stanley Cup pedigree, a vocal leader, someone who leads by example as well, someone who you could trust to kill a penalty, someone who you could trust in his own zone. I really like Jake Muzzin. I have a lot of time for Jake Muzzin. I'm still a fan of his. I'm still hoping that he turns it around. But the no move thing is a little curious, considering that he got 4 years that were going to extend into his mid-30s at above $5 million a year. Not that he couldn't have gotten that somewhere else, but just how that ended up needing to be a throw-in. I do think that's curious, looking back on that a little bit. The second part of it, though, they're not going to trade him this year. I do wonder what the conversation's like this offseason, though. And I do think that it was related in part to Morgan Rielly. To me, the plan has shifted. Morgan Rielly has evolved as a better defenseman. He has become more responsible having played with TJ Brody. He is the Leafs' best defenseman now. And that wasn't always the case. Jake Muzzin used to be the Leafs' best defenseman. A few things happened. They ended up with Rasmus Sandin. I think that they really like him. I think that he offers a surplus at that position. And Morgan Rielly took a step, and they gave him a contract. And yeah, I think that there was a little bit of you gave Muzzin a contract because if Morgan Rielly wasn't going to play ball hometown contract-wise, that maybe you wanted to have some assurances. So yeah, I think it's a pretty multi-layered conversation. But as far as trading him, I don't think that that discussion happens until at least the offseason, and it has to come with a pretty another Leafs failure.
I think we have time for one more quick one. So this is from Yagan from Scarborough. What do you think of using OG plus picks plus Malachi and Boucher to trade for a disgruntled superstar player? Basically what Masai did with DeMar. Is OG our DeMar? I agree with JD that he doesn't seem to fit.
Yeah.
My answer would be, who is that guy?
Yeah. Yeah. Like that.
Russell Westbrook.
Yeah, for Russ, I mean, he gets triple doubles, so you got to go and get him. I think Blake's answer is the correct one, is that it needs to be the right player. But I will say this is, I think that this Raptors team is heading towards a decision of Siakam or OG. At some point, you're going to have to make that call, and I know that upsets a lot of Raptors fans and a lot of Raptors people, but here's the fact. They're not going to get good enough to win a championship with the current construction of their team. And for future first-round picks and salaries and all these things, like, you got to give something up to get something. And if you use OG Anunoby as a trade chip, given his age, his upside, his ability, you're talking about one of the best trade chips that you could possibly have on the market, especially once you start to get into the conversation of, like, additionally a future first round pick. That is the only way that I think you're going to get a superstar to Toronto until Scotty Barnes potentially becomes one. And I don't think that OG will ever become a superstar. I think that he's going to be potentially a better version of what he is now, but what he is now is really, really good. So yeah, if they do go down that path, or if that player does become available, it is nice knowing that you have what could end up ultimately being the trump card, but OG's not someone that you just, you know, you're moving for the sake of moving, or you're trading for the sake of trading. But that being said, yeah, like, for a superstar player, again, of a certain ilk, that's a, you feel pretty good having that in the old chamber, the old trade
quiver.
Chamber. Yeah. In the trade quiver.
Okay, well, on our way out, one text, Goran Dragic, Goran Dragic, Goran Dragic, Goran Dragic, Goran Dragic, Goran Dragic. So that one's for
like
you,
I said, drink a glass of chemicals. That's, you know, hey, go have yourself. Hey, I got a water for you. Here, just have drink this water, Goran Dragic fan.
Just plug your nose and chug it.
Yeah. What we do have for you is Ben Solak, NFL writer at The Ringer and co-host of The Ringer NFL show. We're going to talk a little NFL fake trade for you, JD. Something Ben floated on his own podcast. We're going to talk to him about that. We're going to talk to him about the weekend that was and the weekend ahead in the NFL. That's next. Mm-hmm. The Fan Morning Show, Sports at 590, The Fan.
The Fan Morning Show, Sports at 590, The Fan. Ailis Forfar, Blake Murphy, JD Bunkus. Here with you for another 30 minutes. Going to wrap up with some football talk. Speak to Ben Solak of The Ringer in a minute or two here. I'll start with this before he gets on the line. He's an Eagles fan. And I don't know how much he's retained his fandom or whether or not he's more of a professional. If he's of the Blake Murphy school of, hey, I care, but I'm not going to cheer, you know, one of those. But the fact that he did a Russell Wilson trade, not to the Eagles, you know, that he didn't use all those Eagles draft picks in a fake trade, that he went with a different organization, it tells me all I need to know about his assessment of Russ, and it hurts. It hurts because I feel like it's the truth. Ben Solak, NFL writer and co-host of the Ringer NFL show, he joins us now. Hey, what's up, man? How you doing?
I'm well. How y'all been?
Doing good, man. Doing good. I was just saying before you came on, I'm pretty sure that you're a Philly guy, and I'm upset that you didn't make the Philly Russell Wilson trade, that you're like, nah, you know, I'm good on Russell Wilson, even though we have all these draft picks and a team that made the playoffs. I feel like that tells me a lot about how you feel about Russell Wilson right now.
Listen, they're gonna try, right? I mean, Howie Roseman has been enamored with Russell Wilson since he came out, right? All they ever do is talk about how they were going to draft him and Seattle took him and they took Nick Foles instead. And mm-hmm. Roseman referenced Russell Wilson when they drafted Jalen Hurts in the second round, yeah, saying, we feel like he can be a Russell Wilson type player in terms of his skill set. We didn't want to miss out on him the way we did with Russell Wilson a decade ago. So they've been thinking about him. They've never stopped. So yeah, I think they're going to make that effort. And I wouldn't be surprised if we hear those rumors. And I don't know if Russ wants to be in Philly. It's obviously clear that Russ has, you know, kind of a preferred list of destinations. And so I don't know if it comes to fruition, and I personally wouldn't do it because I think this defense needs so much fixing in Philadelphia, but they're going to try. And if they can come to a deal which is like built around Hurts and probably a couple of first round picks, don't be surprised if they pull the trigger.
Yeah. I will say this. If you, like me, believe that what we've seen from Russell Wilson is more than just a guy who's tired in Seattle, but actually some regression in the play, just at his age, his size, losing a little bit of a step might actually be quite impactful, then, yeah, I don't know if Philly is the market that I would want to go to if I'm Russ and I'm trying to close out a Hall of Fame legacy. Just like with a lot of pressure, giving up a lot of picks, maybe some regression in play, probably not the spot for me. But you wrote about Jalen Hurts, and it seemed like this was my takeaway from your piece, is that, you know, he had a bad game, and there's no doubt about that, but you don't seem really ready to give up on the player. And maybe that's just because you haven't been presented with another option as of right now, but it seemed like even from your, you know, what you just answered me and from the piece, that you don't even seem keen on using any of those three picks on the quarterback position.
If this was a better quarterback class, I'd be keen on it, right? And if this was a quarterback class like last year's, or even, you know, a little bit worse, last year's was really, really good, then yeah, I'd do it. Because I think you've seen from Jalen Hurts, he's got about 20 starts under his belt now, a player who projects to be a spot starter, projects to be a low-end starter, maybe a career journeyman backup type. I called him Marcus Mariota. Right? I think Tyrod Taylor in his career is another good kind of comparison, another good arc. But you don't really see a player who incontrovertibly, inarguably, definitely is that starter who you can build a playoff offense around. I don't think you've seen that yet. So there's nothing wrong with waiting another year. He's done more than enough to justify bringing him back. And you can spend those first-round picks on the defense. And you can develop the receivers around him. And you can look for better quarterback options in the next upcoming years. But make no bones about it, the Eagles will be on the veteran trade market. They'll be looking around the free agent market as well. And they'll take a look at the draft class. I don't think they'll find an option that's better for them than just sticking with Hurts and spending their picks and their money elsewhere. But if they do, they'll take it. Because Hurts has shown you enough that you can keep riding him as a bridge, but I don't think he's shown you enough that you can believe fully he's going to be the future.
So we've been bumping around the idea today about Kyler, especially after last night. They got stomped, and it kind of exposed a couple questions that we had about, is he the future of this team, and can you count on him to be a franchise quarterback, or has that ship sailed this early in his career?
The level of play that you get from Kyler at his peak is very clearly like, it's not just franchise quarterback level. It's really something, right? Like it's mm-hmm. explosive plays. It's creating out of nothingness, right? It's Josh Allen stuff. It's Justin Herbert stuff. It's Patrick Mahomes stuff. That's awesome. Russell Wilson's another good example. The question with Kyler at this point in his career is durability. Once the weather gets cold and the season gets long and the hits start to accumulate, Kyler's play really starts to deteriorate. And this is why you hear we're about to enter the draft cycle. This is why you hear in the draft cycle NFL coaches and old heads and executives always care about big dudes. They don't like it when their quarterback is small. They don't like it when he's slight, right, when he's a thin guy, because there's the feeling that he cannot withstand a 17, 18, 19, 20-week season, and that's always the season you want to have, is a season that goes 18, 19, 20 weeks, that goes into the playoffs. So my thing with Kyler is that we've seen him be a franchise guy. I believe he's that dude. But we've really only seen it up to, like, mid-November. And if he can't bring that ability and bring that consistency into the winter months, really doesn't matter too much what he's doing in the fall. That's a very tricky situation to handle. And you have to be able to sit down with Kyler, sit down with your sports science guys, with your medical team, and say, how do we get Kyler to a position where he feels comfortable playing the way he plays in October, in January? If we can't ever get him there, yeah, like pulling the plug starts to make sense, because you don't build for the fall, you build for the winter, you build to win in the playoffs. So that's the issue facing the Cardinals right now. It is a very tricky one.
Yeah, the point about playing the way he plays was especially notable last night, where, man, just really struggled against the pressure from that Rams defense. I know it's something that you're focused on with the Rams. On the other side of the ball, heading into this week, where the Bucs are a pretty blitz-heavy team, and Stafford kind of picked apart the Cardinals blitzing of him last night. I know Stafford is not the level of quarterback of Tom Brady or some of the other quarterbacks still left in the playoffs, but do you think he can do enough against what the Bucs like to do to quarterbacks next week?
He can. Stafford always can. It's a question of will he, and how long will he do it, and how bad will the mistakes be when he doesn't. You know what I mean? He's that high volatility quarterback that we have to be worried about and aware of. But the thing with Stafford and this Rams offense is that when it's been really stopped this year, it's been stopped by teams who can generate pressure with four. They had the Titans, right, a primetime game. They scored 16 points, but the game was kind of like over in the third quarter. They blitzed fewer than 10% of the time, right? They had only four men on the rush on over 90% of their rushes. Pressured Stafford 28% of his dropbacks. Crazy numbers. Then they caught the Niners the very next week. We saw what the Niners just did to the Cowboys and Dak Prescott. Blitzed on only 13% of their snaps. Pressured Stafford on 23-24% of his dropbacks. If you can keep seven in coverage and gum up these windows and blanket all this space, and you're able to take away maybe the cup option route with a couple of underneath zone defenders, and you're able to just play with some deep, you know, deep cushion outside corners and take away the Odell fade and whatnot, you can make Stafford hold it for an extra beat. This offensive line is beatable, especially on the interior. And Vita Vea and Ndamukong Suh, really, really good interior rushers for Tampa Bay. So Todd Bowles likes to blitz. He loves to blitz. And when he gets to the playoff time, he really believes in his blitzes. He blitzed a ton against Jalen Hurts because Jalen Hurts didn't scare him. Now you have a really big question. Do you want to do what you're good at and blitz Stafford and think your good can beat his good? Or do you want to do what he's bad at and only rush with four and trust this really talented defensive line to get the job done for you? So it's a big question mark for Todd Bowles which way he wants to go. I would hope and imagine, as a smart, good coach, he tries to rush with four and he finds a lot more success. So I think if you start going heavy blitzes on Stafford, he's going to dice you up. And I would hope that the Bucs take a more measured and conservative approach in the defensive front.
So let's stick with quarterbacks here, and we'll just kind of keep bouncing around QBs with you. This game feels like it was a month ago now, the disadvantage, I guess, of being the first game of a six-week slate. But Joe Burrow looked very comfortable against the Raiders in that game on Saturday. 24 for 34, 244 yards, two touchdowns. He's had a very good season overall. How close are you to putting him in, you know, if not the top tier of quarterbacks, solidly in that second tier of guys?
I'm right there with him, solidly in that second tier. I'm nowhere close to putting him in the first tier. Maybe this is – actually, I know for a fact this is just a me thing. I take the word elite seriously. Elite means like top 10%, right? Elite means cream of the crop. If I've got 32 starting quarterbacks in the league, to me there's maximum three elite quarterbacks. And for as long as Mahomes, Rodgers, and Brady are playing football, nobody else is getting there, man. You're not going to be able to leapfrog into that group. They're just too talented, right? So I don't like widening that definition. I don't like widening that top tier, you know, for kind of the flavor of the month for the quarterback who's really elite. And Joe Burrow's been so great. Okay, you know, he's been really, really good this season. But this is a quarterback who has, like, deficiencies in his game. Joe Burrow's lack of arm strength matters and is at times a detriment to the Bengals offense. His pocket management is amazing. The way the guy works around pressure is incredible. But he's not that good of an athlete, right? And that is to his detriment. There are guys like Rodgers and Brady who are also not that good of an athlete who have learned how to work around it and really maximize their ability over the course of like 10, 12, 15 years of starting. Burrow's in his second year in the NFL, still makes mistakes. So there's areas of his game that are deficient. There's areas of his game that don't measure up against like the Lamar Jacksons, Josh Allens, Justin Herberts, and the rest of the tier two group, let alone the tier one guys. So I strongly believe we have to be able to talk about good quarterbacks without just throwing the elite word at all of them and kind of diluting the meaning of that rarefied group. So Joe Burrow's been playing great. He's been incredibly impressive, especially in the context of that offense. Jackson's to do so much. Elite? Talk to me in like 3 years.
I love that answer, especially as someone who routinely tries to have takes about certain players that other people believe are first ballot Hall of Famers, and I don't really believe those things. I do think that what you're saying is correct, that oftentimes we dilute that conversation and we take away some of that special feeling of what it is like to watch an actually truly elite quarterback. I will say this, though. This season, when he was at his best, and I know that if with elite you can have maybe consistency be one of the most important traits of this, but that to me no one played better at his best than Josh Allen did this year. And then you take that Patriots game, and I wonder how far off he is for you in terms of joining that class, and if maybe that is just a, hey, he does what he did to the Kansas City Chiefs again, and he beats Patrick Mahomes, if he is away from joining that class to you.
Yeah, no, he's right. He's certainly closer than Burrow, The peaks that you get from Allen, right, are unstoppable peaks, right? When Allen is at his best, good night. There's no defense. They're not, like, this level of arm strength, size, mobility, it doesn't, there's no call on the call sheet, man. There's no, like, oh, just do X. You don't have it, right? And that's the thing about the Chiefs facing the Bills coming up is this game, man. The Chiefs are the first question you're asking is how do we keep Allen in the pocket and how do we prevent him from beating us with his legs? The Chiefs do not have a single athlete. They're not a very athletic defense. They do not have a single athlete on the defense side of the ball where you're like, him. Let him spy Josh Allen. It'll work. There's nobody, right? So you're playing with against a guy with a stacked deck. You are playing truly 11-on-11 football, and defenses are not built to do that. So the peaks for Allen make him a guy that enters that conversation. And certainly, like you said, it's the consistency. It's how often Allen can get there that leaves him out of it at this stage. Because Josh Allen played the game of his life against the Patriots in the wild card round. It was sick to see. 2 weeks ago, he tried to lose to the Falcons. He threw 3 picks in the second quarter, right? No need for this. We all weren't sure they were going to win this Patriots game because Allen's been really bad in the cold because he doesn't know how to, like, take mustard off of his throws, and he tries to throw it through his receivers, and it, like, hurts to catch his passes. There is stuff about Allen that is deficient, right? And that happened, like, last month, right? So that's why, for me, like, elite is always a conversation that looks at multiple years, multiple seasons, and that's why we have the MVP trophy, and we have the Offensive Player of the Year trophy, and we have all of these first-team All-Pro recognitions to acknowledge these really good individual seasons, these really good individual performances. But in the larger discourse of, like, who's the guy, I want you to do this for a while. I want you to do this to the point where I can't remember when you didn't.
Yeah, that's what I think is most fascinating about next weekend, is whether or not he unlocked that with that Patriots win. Because when you're talking about ripping those balls to receivers' hands, yeah, that's dead on. But that was the one thing that you really noticed the difference of in that game against the Patriots, was the soft touch on some of those throws down the field to certain players. And you go, oh, that's new. That's a new Josh Allen piece that we saw against the Patriots. And he just kicked their ass. And yeah, now I feel like, okay, you do this against the Chiefs, you outplay Patrick Mahomes, and we're maybe going to be having conversations about how you might be the best player in football next year, which is nuts considering how we feel about Mahomes. Or conversely, Mahomes wins and we go, oh, nothing actually matters. We should never talk about anything in the first 7 weeks, like Kyler Murray stinks in the playoffs and Mahomes is going to another AFC championship game. We're all fools for doing this. You know, and I'm trying not to be a prisoner of the moment, Ben, but you know, you raised some interesting points when you were talking about Kyler and just the way that, hey, they're going to have to try to evaluate what they do with him moving forward, how they handle him, how they get him to be the October Kyler Murray later in the season. And I wonder if there's a larger thing at play here, because a couple of seasons ago after Russell Wilson, there was sort of a, hey, let's not focus so much on quarterback size anymore. Baker Mayfield gets drafted. Kyler Murray gets drafted first overall. You know, you have Jalen Hurts come into the league. There's sort of the shift. I don't think Lamar Jackson is as short as those guys, but he's a slight in-frame guy. Lamar got beat up this year. He didn't finish the season. Baker Mayfield didn't finish the season. He ends up with the shoulder injury. You have Kyler Murray, who ends up being that version of Kyler Murray come postseason time. Russell Wilson, same thing. I know he's older. He's put more of a track record together, but I think that he lost something physically this year, and I guess he got better as the year went on, but either way, maybe there's actually a thing with the NFL now where we start looking at a longer NFL season, a longer regular season, more of a prioritization on getting that number one seed, and we start caring more about quarterback size. Maybe I'm diminishing how we already feel about it, but do you think that there could actually be a bit of a ripple effect here in terms of the way organizations evaluate quarterback size, which didn't feel as big of a deal for the last couple of seasons?
Absolutely right. So the league develops on a pendulum swing, right? We go back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And the truth is always somewhere in the middle, that natural resting point that the pendulum like eventually gets to, but usually it's just passing through. And so that's where we are with quarterback size, right? 7 years ago, whatever, 6 years ago, I'm trying to remember. Like, Brock Osweiler was a first-round pick, man. It was like, he's 6'7", good, bang. You know what I mean? Paxton Lynch out of Memphis, big, huge arm. Let's do it. Yeah. And we didn't know how to develop these guys, right? We weren't able to take these athletes and make them into these really quality passers. And then the spread started to come into the league, right? Spread offense, spread and shred them. And all of a sudden, you can take a guy like Josh Allen in round one. He just talked glowingly about Allen. We got to remember that nobody liked him coming out, right, in the media. Like, nobody thought this was going to be a good pick. He was horrible in his first year. But you're able to get him to the point where the offense works because you can spread, right? The Bills live in all these spread formations. You can generate these wider throwing windows in zone. There's no way a team can close those windows fast enough because Allen's got an absolute bullet of an arm. And then you can evolve him in the running game, and all of a sudden it's a defensive end running at you, right? It's Cam Newton, like it's 6'5", 240. Nobody wants to tackle this guy. So we found a way to make this model of athlete work. But when we invited the spread, we also invited these quick little popgun passers, Baker Mayfield, Kyler Murray, right, who can just go and zip this thing around, right, just get the ball quickly, RPO, get the ball quickly out on a screen. They don't have to worry about throwing middle of the field, right? It's difficult for short quarterbacks to see that middle area of the field. They don't got to worry about that. They can generate a little bit in the running game, right? Pressure comes, they can scoot around a little bit, and they can keep this offense moving. So we said, all right, now we can bring in these guys. And then, like you say, we realize the endurance of these players, the ability to take hits and withstand them, just the NFL rigor, might not be what we thought it was, right? Drew was so healthy for so long. Drew Brees in New Orleans. Russ, before the season, was an Iron Man, right? But these were dense dudes, right? Drew Brees and Russell Wilson were thicker guys. So it's not so much about the height as it is about the slight. I think about Kyler Murray, he's a thin guy, right? You brought up Lamar. Lamar's been really impressively healthy. He's a thin guy, got the high ankle sprain. Zach Wilson's another one where there were concerns about Zach coming out of BYU. You know, he weighed in at 210 at the combine. Nobody thought he was actually 210 when he was playing at BYU, right? This is a thinner guy. And so it's a pendulum that swings, that tries to figure out a happy medium between we love arm strength, we love size, but these are the sort of players that can execute this offense, and we can get them for kind of cheap, and we know that they're going to be good early, but what happens when they take hits? It's a moving target, difficult science. So we'll see that pendulum swing back and forth over the next however many years you want in NFL football.
Here's to more Brock Osweilers. Ben Solak, yep. NFL writer for The Ringer, co-host of The Ringer NFL Show. Thanks, as always, for making time, man. We appreciate it.
Of course. Y'all be well now.
Take care. Yeah, I'm not advocating. Here's where I would actually be with it is I like the point about thicker dudes and guys who have that more track record of durability or maybe even play in some environments where you're asked to have more of those hits throughout college. You show a little bit more of that. But to me, it's just like if you're going to go with those players, they have to be especially special now. You know, like if you look at the Baker pick now in hindsight, it looks so bad. Not only who was taken after him, but just, yeah, that if this is today, right, if Baker Mayfield ends up in the draft today, you're not talking about him going first overall because we're probably shifting back towards, hey, you know what? The 6 foot guy we probably don't want to have if he doesn't have a special trait to that 6 feet tall. And that's the thing with Baker, where they went, oh, it's his brain. Oh, it's his confidence. It's his bravado. You don't do that anymore if the guy's 6 feet tall. Maybe that's the lesson that we're learning here.
Yeah. Look, Trevor Lawrence is 6 foot six. You don't have to talk to me about tall quarterback prospects. Yeah. But no, I like that we're
six.
Yeah. I like that we're bookending the show today with, you know what? JD and Blake no longer viable as quarterback options at 5 foot 10.
I'm still viable in flag football leagues. I'll tell you what, like it's
you're a slot receiver at best.
I've
got the neck and the butt to be like a fullback or something.
I got flag football championship belts hanging on the wall.
Count the rings.
Ooh, cool.
That's right. Count the rings. That's right. Throwing it downfield. Co-ed.
Slinging it.
Yeah.
Put that in your Tinder bio.
Co-ed champion quarterback. No big deal. In his Wranglers. No big deal. Subscribe to this podcast. Leave a review. Thanks for all the texts today. We always love them. We'll see you tomorrow when there are sports back on again. It's the Fan Morning Show, Ailish Forfar, Blake Murphy, JD Bunkus, Sportsnet 590 The Fan.